Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. Along with John, KC2 WGB, John and Dick attempt to organize and run this thing called the Technical Met. It's been around for 29 years. The main reason the Technical Met exists is because ham radio operators have curiosity to come together and help educate each other as to how all of this wireless equipment works. It's kind of complicated. There's an awful lot to learn about how radio equipment really works. The antennas, the transmission lines, the receivers, the various kinds of propagation, the 26 different kinds of ham radio. An FM repeater, 2-meter ham radio you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds. So it can be an extremely educational hobby. This particular repeater has rather good coverage of northern New Jersey, western Connecticut, southern New York State, much of Long Island. In that metropolitan New York City area, there's an awful lot of brain power. And the TechNet attempts to tap into that brain power. What takes place on the Technical Met, most of it gets recorded. And there's a website you can visit to listen to the last 6 years worth of TechNet. You have 4 hours worth per Sunday night, 6 years worth of them, thousands of hours worth of it. It's at the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go to that website and you look at the Limark section, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, and that's the club that hosts this particular repeater. You'll see 6 years worth of recording. And there's quite an educational package there. There are a number of college professors that tell their students, if you want to see what real radio is like, listen to the TechNet or go to that particular website. There are college professors telling people to, telling their students, and that's one way of getting a little bit more exposure to what radio is really like. The main thing you'll notice about people who check into the TechNet that they have in common, in my opinion, is curiosity. And that's an extremely good thing. If you look at the progress that mankind has made, the majority of the time that progress took place because somebody had curiosity. What is Mother Nature telling you? How does this thing really work? How do you make it work better? How did Mother Nature do it? How does this piece of electronics work? And so on. Curiosity is part of what's going on. You'll occasionally hear some disruptive sounds on the TechNet. And you'll have to decide what you're going to do about that. Are you going to get angry? Are you going to just turn off the rig and go somewhere else? That's approach number one. Approach number two is to recognize the fact that John and I and Glenn and others can usually hear what someone is asking by listening on the input, and we repeat the question. So the TechNet proceeds a little bit more slowly, but usually it proceeds. Well, the third choice is to say I haven't got the time to wait for a slower TechNet, and that I'm going to wait until it gets recorded a day or two later, go to the website, play it back, and fast forward through the sections that have the disruptive sound. Those are your three choices. And maybe there's a fourth choice that you guys will be telling me about. There's another thing I was going to say. So the main schedule of what we do on the TechNet is that in the beginning we take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. The fact that you're just listening and you want your call letters announced over the air, you really need not do that. We don't do that. Other nets do that. They have great big long lists of people who are listening. We don't do that, and we speed things up a little bit. We also don't start off with a net always asking the unanswered question, is there someone that has emergency traffic at this time? The people who do that on every single net, I don't quite understand that. But the long list of people who are listening, after 29 years of the TechNet, we believe somebody is listening. It wouldn't last that long. So you'll save us some time if you just check in if you've got a question or a comment. We make a sincere effort to answer people's questions at least briefly during the first hour. And so in theory, you don't have to wait longer than an hour to at least get a brief answer. At the end of that hour, John goes to Mel's Corner. KC2WGB is now collecting questions from guys who don't yet have their license, the guys that are just getting into the hobby. They don't have a voice to get on the net and ask their question directly live, which is the way we answer those questions. So he chooses two, three, or four of those particular significant letters and that have general interest, and we read them and try to answer those questions. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert, who tells us what NASA has been doing, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. After that, And after those three scheduled items, we then go into the deeper subjects. Vito presented some very nice information to me about what really took place on the Titanic and what the hardware really looked like. John has usually some questions. He's now investigating. Let me drop. About if you're making specific measurements where you want to know how a particular piece of radio equipment is behaving up close, where you're making traceable measurements to the Bureau, where you want to know volts per meter or amps per meter of signal strength up close, and you want to create shielding with a Faraday cage or an anechoic chamber or whatever. John is conducting a series of experiments in which he's discovering how those things work, how you make those measurements, how you interpret it. And an awful lot of that is not common sense, as you, for those who listened in late last week, you found out that there's a lot more going on with the so-called Faraday shield and the word grounding. When somebody says, I grounded my radio so that I can stop making television interference, well, at a VHF frequency, you run a piece of wire from your particular equipment or from your antenna to what you think is a ground, no matter what that ground is, whether it's a sheet of metal that's a square mile in your backyard, or whether it's a water pipe, whether it's a grounding rod 8 foot long sunk into wet soil, no matter what you think is ground. The 60 cycle grounding, yes. For radio grounding, an awful lot of what you think is ground is not. It becomes a very relative word, and you'll find out some more about that. Wesley, N2XJN, has this week been investigating something called a magnetic clutch, magnetic powder in a kind of a device where you put current through it, and all of a sudden it does an extremely linear job of determining exactly how much torque you get between the input shaft and the output shaft of this clutch-like mechanism. And how in the world does that work? Well, I've got some guesses as to how it works because I've got some experience with an entirely different puzzle. I collect these physics puzzles. Let me drop. I got 30 physics puzzles that I asked my engineering-oriented friends from time to time if they can tolerate it, which it's not, the intention is not to display ignorance of people. It's, the intention is to show where certain portions of the education we all get have holes in that information. And so by people attempting to answer these questions, they find out whether or not their particular education did tell them something about that subject. And in the process of finding out what I believe is the correct answer, some education takes place. Well, one of my puzzles happens to approach this area that Wes is now investigating, called the magnetic powder clutch. Okay, at this time I'm going to take check-ins. A typical check-in might sound like this, WA2PJF, Vito, from Bayshore. And yes, you're going to give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a comment or a question for the net. So give me that information right now. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
82BHY, yes?
Okay, Jim is our first sign-in. And Jim I know very well, so he didn't have to tell me his name. But most of you guys should give me your call letters, your name, and then the word yes. Who else would like to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time. K2RIW.
Anyone else?
Yes.
And the topic before technical stuff is robust decoder. So you can book me on the line.
Okay, yeah. I think Wes is saying he has a question on blank coils. I missed that word, Wes. Something like Veluxy coils, I think is what you said, and I didn't quite understand that. Want to try again, Wes? K2RIW.
It's Veluxy coils for transient current measurement. I'm listening to you at the same time. I can switch off the receiver just like they can hear so much. The regular topic for ham radio amateur. I don't believe we should wait with that till the end of the TechNet. It's just a very much interesting subject, and I have sent you the email like 5 minutes before the TechNet.
You want a spelling on that, Dick?
Yeah, the so 5 minutes before the check-in, you did send me an email, which means I haven't seen it yet. And go ahead and tell me the spelling on that one, John. You got it, John.
ROGOWSKI.
Okay, ROGOWSKI, Rogowski Coils. Doesn't sound like an Irish name. That's a joke. Okay, so we've got Jim and Wes who signed in so far. One more call. Anyone else to sign in with a question or a comment for the TechNet? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening. Is there anyone else to check in?
I'll do a check in. K2 Mike Yankee Ray with a question.
Okay, Mike Yankee. I think it was Kilo Charlie 2 Mike Yankee. Is that true, Ray? Do I have your call letters correct?
Yes, Dick. It's Ray up in Yonkers. Tom and Andrew guy. Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Yankee.
Very fine. We got you, Ray. All right, let's start up with Jim first. And how are things going with you, Jim? I know you're in the process of putting up, I believe, something like a G5RB antenna, a 80 through 10 meter or 80 through 6 meter rig that has been given to you by Rich N2EO, and I know that he's making some repairs on that. So I wonder how all that's getting together. I know that eventually you're going to want to try 6 meters, the so-called magic band. KD2BHY from, I think, Port Washington. K2RIW in the tech man.
Thanks, Rick. Rich is working on that radio, and he said he's got the transmitter and receiver working, but the meter is a little bent out of shape, so he said he's going to fix that up and see when he's going to give it to me. Today I had a question about in the microwave band. I was watching some videos on YouTube earlier today on ham radio and contact, and there was one guy who was on 10 gigahertz, and he made a contact with a feed horn antenna. Got it. Usually you would have, most of the time, say on 10 meters, you would have a dipole, which would have to be resonant on 10 meters in order to work for 10 meters or be efficient at transmitting and have a low SWR at 10 meters. But what I was kind of puzzled about is how these higher frequency feed horns and parabolic dishes, how are they resonant at these frequencies, and if they are resonant at these frequencies, I really have no idea, and I was kind of puzzled. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, Don, good question, Jim. For the HF frequencies, 80 through 10 meters, dipole-like antennas are almost always in the vicinity of a half wavelength long, mechanically quite often, electronically sure for sure, and if you use various techniques of squeezing them down in size by using loading coils, top hat capacitors, and squiggling them back and forth, you can make the mechanical dimensions of a dipole a bit smaller than halfway, but electronically it's a halfway long. So halfway long dipole-like antennas, an assembly of dipoles, and a Yagi antenna, a cubical quad antenna, a loop antenna, and so on, for HF frequencies all the way up to at least 150 megacycles or so, those are popular antennas. When you start getting closer to the microwave frequencies, closer to 1,000 megacycles and above, you almost don't use coaxial cable anymore. You almost don't use twin lead anymore. You start using waveguide. When it comes to high-power radar systems at 1,000 megs and above, the transmission line between the antenna and the transmitter is usually waveguide. And the reason for that is waveguide has lower loss at those frequencies, but the waveguide itself has a little bit of a dipole-like characteristic. Let me drop. Yes, the waveguide looks like a rectangular pipe. It looks a little bit like a piece of air conditioning ductwork. And it only works if the major dimension, the width across the waveguide, is a half wavelength at that frequency or longer. Then the signal will go down that pipe. without a center conductor. Ordinary coax cable requires a center conductor. Waveguide doesn't, if it's a half wavelength. And if you take a look at the waveguide to coax launcher, the thing that goes from coax cable and sends the signal down the waveguide, that launching structure really is a quarter wave ground plane antenna. There's a probe in there coming from the center conductor of the coaxial input connector. That quarter wave long, like a probe, launches a signal. It's a ground plane-like antenna, all built inside that shielded structure, and it launches that signal down the waveguide. So waveguide, once you're starting to use it, it becomes the lowest loss transmission line, usually above 1,000 megacycles. By the time you get to 10,000 megacycles, almost no coax more than a couple of feet long is reasonable. You're going to be using waveguide. Once you've got the signal going down the waveguide, you then want to radiate it into space. You could, if you want to, just simply open up the end of the waveguide. And that would be a 6 dB over isotropic gain antenna. An open-ended piece of waveguide, it's got about a 1.5 standing wave ratio, and it radiates the signal into space pretty well, about as well as a three-element Yagi would. However, if the open end of the waveguide, if now you flare it out, so it looks like a horn, and so the throat of the horn, the waveguide going into it, is at least a half wavelength wide, but then you flare out the metal on the four sides so that it becomes 2, 3, 4, 5 wavelengths wide at the open mouth of the horn, now you can develop extra gain. It is the, it's a small version of a parabolic dish, is repeater, timeout, cancel. It's a small version of a parabolic dish, is one way of looking at it. You could literally put a lens in front of the horn to do a little bit more focusing, so to speak, but waveguide, microwave frequencies, flared out into a horn is a beautiful antenna, works very well, easy to construct out of a copper sheet or a tin foil, or you can literally wrap a copper foil on top of a plastic form of some form to make that horn. I've built horns that way. So with microwave frequencies, the principle of operation is almost the same, but the hardware starts looking very different. Once the wavelengths start becoming very small, different optical-like structures do the aiming. And in the case of that horn, you usually have to aim it to the nearest couple of degrees. It has a signal coming out of there that's kind of a pencil-like thing, or like a flashlight. If you could see the wave coming out of there, it's like a flashlight. You have to aim it in the right direction. So most of these microwave guys, they know ahead of time who they're talking to and what compass heading he is from where you're standing. If you know what I mean, if you're on top of a mountain, you want to aim in the right direction to get the guy that's on top of the other mountain. And in the beginning, guys who do microwave work usually do it from mountaintop to mountaintop. However, the smarter guys are finding ways of operating 10 gigahertz equipment from their house, from the top of the tower, and now getting the signal up to the top of the tower through the somewhat lossy piece of transmission line. That in itself requires some fancy electronics, where you do the, you put the receiver, the major portion of the receiver, you put it at the top of the tower, and you only bring the IF signal back down through the cable, if you know what I mean. That's the way I did 10 gigs. So you can see an awful lot of this information, Jim. Let me drop it. If you go to Tom Williams, Dr. Tom Williams' website, he's Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, W-A-1-M-G-A, M-B-A, I think it's M-B-A or M-G-A. I got to check on that. Dr. Tom Williams, W-A-1, Mike Bravo Alpha, or is it Mike Bravo Alpha? Maybe it's M-B-A. Anyhow, I'll get those call letters for you. When you find the right website, on his first page of the website, Dr. Tom Williams has, by the way, knowing Williams, you can look him up another way in the QRZ.com by knowing the name. I'm a little worried about that one, though. There may be a whole lot of Williamses out there. He's got a web page that gives you a nice introduction to microwave ham radio, and he refers to a whole lot of other websites that have information. So when you finally get the right seed websites, as I'm going to call them, and you start branching out from those and you're learning microwave, that is a more rare kind of ham radio. The higher class guys with the, in many cases, the doctorate degrees, start working there. However, there are people who have nowhere near as much technical background who still go there and enjoy it an awful lot. And so there's a lot of spectrum. When it comes to the total number of megacycles, The total number of megacycles given to ham radio operators is about 100 times more bandwidth given to the microwave ham radio operators than are to the HF. So if you want the wide open spaces where you can do experiments with very high speed digital data, transmission of television pictures, and things like that, three-dimensional pictures, to do that on microwaves is relatively easy. To get permission to do that on 80 through 10 meters would be very difficult to get people to give you that much bandwidth, if you know what I mean, and to have the permission to radiate that kind of a signal. So each kind of signal has its favorite frequency region where it works the best. This is only a thumbnail sketch of the beginning of what the word microwave is. I'm glad you've asked me that question, Jim, because of all of my 40-some-odd years of ham radio operating, I think the majority of it has been on the so-called microwave frequencies, and when I come down to 144 megacycles, which is usually my first IF frequency, when I'm on 10 gigahertz, to me, 144 megacycles is not a real radio frequency, that's an IF frequency. It's just a matter of the way you look at it, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Jim, and I'll try to give you those exact call letters so you can find Dr. Tom Williams' website, KD2BHY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hey, thanks for all that information, Dick. I'll definitely check out his website, and yeah, that was pretty interesting. I was just kind of confused about how that happened, and you explained it perfectly.
Yeah, I just did a confirmation. It is Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. And I'm going to double check right now. If we go to WA1MBA, and I think it's .org. About to find out, or is it .com? I think it's .org. I believe we're going to get Dr. Tom Williams. Yes, that's it. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. He's got a very nice section there that gives you introduction to microwaves. And by the way, when you go to the very bottom of his first page list, you'll see Yagi impedance information by K2RIW. That also got onto his particular website. But from there, there's two or three other European sites you can go to that give you another set of pictures and another set of ways of explaining what microwaves are. But among the really sophisticated, very curious, and highly interested types of ham radio, the microwavers are an elite group. You'll find them a lot more interesting to talk to from my point of view. Not everyone's going to agree with me on that one. And I'll give you another couple of hints here, and that is, in the general population, one human being per 500 in the United States is a ham radio operator. One per 500. What is that? 0.2% of the population. Among the really serious homebrew microwave ham radio operators, there's one of them per 500 hams. One per 500 hams is a true dyed-in-the-wool serious microwaver, and one person per 500 in the general population is a ham radio operator. So the true serious microwave ham radio operators, there's four of them per million. As you can see, from some people's point of view, they're the creme de la creme. They're really rare guys. However, as rare as they are, as rare as they are, they get together a couple of times per year at places like the microwave update, also the round tables that are held in London, and there's a similar microwave group that gets together in Germany, and there's a similar group that gets together in Japan. So once per year, these guys from about 20 different countries are so interested in their subject. For 3 days at a time, they'll get together, about 150 of them. Sometimes they bring their wives, but sometimes they don't. But they hold these conferences in various places around the world for about 3 days at a time. I've gone to quite a few of those, and my goodness, is it intense. So these guys, stay up to the wee hours of the morning telling each other war stories and showing each other pictures and giving each other lectures and whatever. And these guys, they don't even turn on the television set. Some of them don't even use their cell phone. They don't connect to the outside world when they go to one of these conferences. There could have been a major war, and they would have never found out about it. 3 days later, they sleep up, catch up on their sleep that they've lost over the last 3 days, and then go back to normal living, if you know what I mean. They're a pretty intense group, and once you go to one of these conferences, you'll say, wow, something else. The last microwave update that was in our area was held in Connecticut about a year or two ago. Back to you for any other final questions or comments, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I just, thanks so much for all that information, and it was really interesting, and I was just very puzzled when I saw that. And thank you for all that, and you really explained it quite clearly back to me.
Yeah, when you do get a chance to go to a good-sized technical library, and you look up a book called the Engineering Handbook. Why can't I think of the name of it now? I'm going to take a look at one of them. Yes, Antenna Engineering Handbook. You look up a book called Antenna Engineering Handbook, which is now in its fourth or fifth edition, and you start scanning through that book, particularly the latest editions, which are with a lot more photographs, you're going to find out there's 5,000 kinds of antennas. Horn antennas, parabolic dish antennas, and many other kinds of microwave antennas are just some of those 5,000 kinds. You talk to the average electrical engineer coming out of a good electrical engineering school in the United States, and I've done that because I interview these guys that are about to join the particular company I'm working for. That's happened to me quite a few times. I ask them, how many kinds of antennas do you think they are? And guys will come up with numbers like 10, 20, 50. And I say, your professor hasn't even scratched the surface. There's at least 5,000 kinds, and you haven't been exposed to them yet. So the majority of the world doesn't know how many kinds of antennas. So, and every piece of sheet metal on your automobile, every slot you cut in that sheet metal, every slot between the fender and the body of the car, the side view mirror, if you're smart enough, every one of those things can be turned into a microwave antenna, and maybe even a VHF antenna, if you know what I mean. Okay, I'm going to go over to Ray next. Ray from Yonkers. What would you like to ask the TechNet tonight, Ray? KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, let me just see if I got it with the microphone.
You sound good. Your audio is a tiny bit low, but you sound good. Go right ahead. Ray, there was absolutely positively not one little snippet of audio on that last transmission. So maybe that microphone is intermittent. Maybe you've got a tap on it or whatever. That whole last transmission, not one single bit of audio. Want to give it another try? Go right ahead, Ray.
Okay, let's do this as a test. Do you hear me now?
I'm hearing you beautiful now. Let's hope that next time you come back, the audio will be there. Go right ahead.
Okay, it's just a flaky connection. My question was, to electronic circuits, why is, if I can phrase it right, a high input impedance desirable? They always seem to make it sound desirable. And I'm talking about input to FETs or bipolar transistors or even microphones when you get to it on your radio, audio amps, all kinds of stuff. High input impedance, I see it all the time. It seems backwards to me. It seems like a high input impedance would be a high resistance to AC, and it would be a bad thing. So why do they preach it as if it's a good thing, and maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what that is. I hope you got my transmission. Thanks.
You sure did, Ray. We got every bit of that transmission, and it came through beautifully. I remember having a very similar set of questions when I first got into ham radio way back in the late 50s. As you read various data sheets and whatever for things like microphones, you're led to believe that high impedance is desirable. That's not necessarily true. If you want maximum signal to go from point A to point B, then matching the impedance is much more important than using high impedance or low impedance. Matching the impedance. If I've got a 50-ohm impedance antenna, and I've got a 50-ohm impedance transmitter, and I connect the two with a 50-ohm impedance piece of coaxial cable, then I have matched the impedance coming out of the transmitter into the cable, I have matched the impedance coming out of the cable into the antenna, and I get maximum energy transfer. In that particular case, if I went to a high impedance, which might be 600 ohms or 6,000 ohms, and I tried to feed that piece of 50 ohm coaxial cable, only a small fraction of that signal would go down the cable, an awful lot of it would be reflected back. So the important thing is to match impedance. Now, in the case of a field effect transistor, the peculiarity, the peculiarity of a field effect transistor is that the input terminal, which is usually called the gate, it's equivalent to the grid of a vacuum tube, it naturally has a high impedance. On many of the field effect transistors that you might use at HF frequencies, the input impedance of that transistor might be 3,000 ohms of resistance shunted with 3 picofarad of capacitance. That's a very high impedance. So if you're going straight into that transistor as a low noise amplifier, your 50 ohm antenna would have to go through some kind of an impedance matching network, probably a kind of an inductor and capacitor setup in just the right configuration so it steps up the impedance, so that now your 50 ohm antenna is stepped up to 3,000 ohms in order to go input to that particular field effect transistor. Conversely, a real high power bipolar transmitting transistor, your final stage transistor, might have an input impedance of 2 ohms. And I'm not kidding. Some of them have an input impedance of 2 ohms shunted by 500 picofarad of capacitance. In that particular case, your 50 ohm source of signal out of your signal generator would have to go through a slightly different kind of inductor capacitor network, which takes the 50 ohms out of the signal generator, steps it down to 2 ohms in order to properly feed that bipolar power transistor that's in the final stage. So depending on what kind of electronics you're dealing with, very small number of ohms, even a fraction of an ohm, sometimes exists. Sometimes a circuit has an impedance of thousands of ohms, and so impedance matching is what allows the maximum amount of energy to be transferred from point A to point B. So if you were using a FET transistor, yes, you would be looking for high impedance antennas. If you were testing power if you're testing power transistors, high power final stage bipolar transistors, you'd be looking for very low source impedance sources of signal. But in many cases, impedance matching, once you learn how to do it, is not too difficult. Understanding at first how it works is kind of difficult. In the case of a transformer that has a 110-volt winding on the primary and a 6-volt winding on the secondary, in the old days to feed filaments of tubes at 6 volts, it really has a different turns ratio. And by taking the square of the turns ratio, primary to secondary, you could find out what the impedance ratio is. So an ideal transformer with a different number of turns in the primary and the secondary is one way of making impedance change, higher or lower, whichever way you want to go. But it doesn't have to be a transformer. There's ways of doing it with one inductor and one capacitor set up just right. At least at a fixed frequency, you can, without very much difficulty, step up the impedance or step down the impedance. But impedance matching is usually the main thing you desire. That's not the whole story, but I think it'll help you somewhat, Ray. KC2 MMY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2 Mike Yankee. Maybe just two quick additions. So what would happen if I put a low impedance mic on a high impedance input, or vice versa, for a radio? Would I blow the audio circuit up? And also, in the case of an oscilloscope, my scope, you know, they preach it has a high input impedance. Why is that? Is that because they want to make it a protective device? So those will be my last two additions, and thanks very much so far.
Yeah, rather good additional questions there, Ray. If I took a low impedance dynamic microphone, that's the one that really has a miniature loudspeaker inside, and if I connected that to a high impedance input type transmitter, nothing bad would happen. However, most likely the audio you would get would be much too low in volume, and other than that, everything would work like a charm. If you did it the other way around, if you took a high impedance microphone and connected it to a kind of a radio that requested a low impedance dynamic microphone input, most likely the impedance mismatch again would give you low audio, and because the microphone is now being loaded down by a much lower impedance than it was designed for, the possibility exists that the microphone would give you some distortion, or it would not have the right frequency response. It might emphasize the low frequency notes compared to the high frequency notes, or vice versa. The microphone is only going to give you specified performance from the data sheet from the manufacturer if it sees the right kind of load on it. So, with rare exception, mismatching impedances are not damaging. You just don't get full performance. About the only example I can think of where damage could occur is that if your transmitter is made for a 50 ohm output and it desires to have a less than 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, and you connect it to a 2 ohm load or a 2000 ohm load, in other words, a load that's highly mismatched, either too high or too low an impedance as a load on the output of your transmitter, if the transmitter has a protect circuit, it will turn itself off or turn itself down to a low power in order to self-protect that final stage. If the final stage did not have self-protect, and if you ran it for a considerable period of time, this is only now a high power output final stage of a transmitter, and you run that for a continuous period of time into either a short circuit or an open circuit, unless the final stage transistor was designed with a lot of conservativeness in its power dissipation. If it's a 100-watt transmitter, and if the manufacturer was smart enough to put a 1,000-watt transistor in there doing it, then nothing would happen. But that's not realistic. That would be expensive and a waste of money. If you've got a 100-watt transistor, damaged, because it's either going to have too big a voltage swing, which is going to create secondary breakdown in the transistor, or if it's going into a short circuit, it's going to draw too much current, create extra heating, and the extra heating can damage it. So only on high-power circuits are you likely to experience damage when you mismatch the impedances. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about an oscilloscope. Let me drop. The most popular kind of voltmeter way back in the 1960-1970 era, the most popular kind of voltmeter was either Triplett or Simpson volt ohm milliammeter. They had 20,000 ohms per volt of impedance. If I'm using the 3 volt full scale reading on that meter, 3 times 20 would be 60. There would be 60,000 ohms of impedance in that meter when I'm on the 3 volt scale. If I desired to measure the automatic gain control voltage on my tube type receiver in that era, where the automatic gain control, the AGC voltage, AVC voltage it's sometimes called, had an impedance of around 1 million ohms. That was the way the circuit worked inside the radio. The automatic volume control had roughly 1 million ohms of internal impedance to that circuit. And if I connected my volt ohm milliammeter, my Triplett or Simpson, which only has 60,000 ohms of resistance to it, I connected across that circuit, I would load down the circuit. What really might be 3 volts there, I would only measure half a volt because of the loading I created by the voltmeter. I created a shunt resistor on a high impedance circuit, and I disturbed the circuit. I lowered the voltage that I would measure. I'm creating an error because I don't have the right kind of a meter. You take a modern day digital voltmeter, and almost all of them have a 10 million ohm input impedance. And if I put the 10 million ohm impedance meter across my automatic volume control circuit that has 1 million ohms, now I'm creating almost no loading at all. The voltage I read will be very accurate. By the same token, let me drop. A well-made oscilloscope, particularly with the times 10 probe being used, a well-made oscilloscope has a impedance on that probe of about 1 million ohms, sometimes 10 million ohms. In other words, when you connect the oscilloscope to various parts of your radio circuit to measure the voltage waveform that's there, you'd like the impedance of the oscilloscope to be as high as possible so that it does not create disturbance to the circuit, does not overly load the circuit, does not disturb the voltage you're trying to measure. is a kind of a Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You would like your instrumentation to measure what's really there without disturbing it. And so by the oscilloscope being well designed to have very high impedance, it can do that. If I was measuring a 1 million ohm impedance circuit, like that automatic voltage control on my old-fashioned tube receiver, and if I use the 50-ohm input terminal of the oscilloscope, and I'm putting 50 ohms across the circuit that's designed for 1 million ohms, I'm going to measure a couple of millivolts of apparent voltage, even though the real voltage there when it's unloaded, when I'm not connecting to it, is really 3 volts. So I'm going to see the wrong thing. Unless I'm very smart to know what I'm doing and compensate for it, I'm getting the wrong reading. So in that particular case, when I'm connecting instrumentation to a circuit under test, I'd like the impedance to be as high as possible so that the circuit thinks that I haven't done anything when I connect to that instrumentation. I wonder if that makes some more sense, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW on the TechNet.
W2VMP.
Okay, Dick, that clears quite a few things up. Now I know why it's desirable on instrumentation. So I'll turn it back to TechNet. Thank you so much. And maybe you can answer, just like on my way out, can I ask, what's the typical voltage of a radio wave in space? Are we talking about milli, micro, nano, or pico volts? Or even volts, for that matter, because I think I calculated 70 volts coming out of the radio if you do the pico squared over R thing, or I, whatever. I can't remember the equation. So maybe you could just tell me that quickly without a large explanation, and then back to the TechNet, and thank you so much.
I think I heard KE2EJ very noisy. Before that, I heard Joe, BMP. Let me find out if Eric wants to tell us something. KE2EJ, you're right ahead.
It's about amplifiers. As you remember, last night the night before, I was working on a television transmitter. The end result was that the protection circuits in the transmitter protected it from a very, very high SWR from the antenna. So the output of this particular 5-kilowatt transmitter survives because there is a certain amount of circuitry in it that allows it to reduce the power, deal with the impedance mismatch from the antenna that actually had a short in it, and unfortunately we have to wait for the rigging to come to fix the antenna, but that's just the reality of it. And oh, by the way, that power block, that power detector is a thermocouple, and I did think this. P2RWK2.
Very fine. I'm hearing you dead full quieting on the input. Through the repeater, you were about 50% noise, but we heard all your words, not to worry. Unusual that you fixed that bolometer, and it was a bolometer type. They're the older type. The good news about the bolometer type, sensing heads, oh, I see there's quite a bit of noise on the machine tonight. The bolometer heads, because of the rain, most likely. I can tell it must be raining pretty hard right now in Queens, where the repeater is located. The good news about a bolometer type sensing head on a power meter is they tend to be very good at giving you true RMS power. But they usually are not quite as sensitive. They don't go down as far to very, very weak signals. Whereas the crystal detectors, some of them can go down to minus 60 and minus 70 dBm. But they are not true RMS detectors in general, and they have all kinds of compensating circuits. So your high-power broadcast transmitter had some very intelligently designed protect circuits that would sense the fact that the impedance mismatch at the antenna was there, and so the circuit self-protected, went back to a lower power so as not to damage that final stage until you guys get the chance to send the rigger up there to fix the antenna. Now, to answer Ray's last question, most of the signals you're listening to on your handy-talky right now, or your benchtop radio that you're listening to right now, or your mobile rig, in most cases, Ray, that signal has an amplitude coming out of that antenna cable of a couple of microvolts. Most radio signals are in the microvolt region unless you're very, very close to the transmitter. If you're close to the transmitter, oh yes, you can measure volts, and sometimes lots of volts when you're super close. There's this inverse square law. Let me drop it. Every time you double the distance between you and a transmitter, you get one quarter of the amount of power. The signal would go down one S unit, 6 decibels, one S unit on your S meter every time you double the distance between you and a transmitter. So when you're super close, you can get strong signals. When you're at maximum range, you're usually down to microvolts. A good handy talkie will have moderately good performance at a quarter of a microvolt of signal input. Not many of them go very much below that. But a real good receiver, a quarter of a microvolt. You would think that's the weakest radio signal you can ever listen to. There are very fancy kinds of radio astronomy type, radiometer type receivers made to specifically measure super weak signals. They can measure signals in the nanovolt region, 10 to the minus 9 volt region. What's the weakest signal you can ever measure? There is no limit if you've got the right kind of integration factor, noise equivalent bandwidth. There's a whole bunch of variables involved. So, but to answer your main question, the majority of the signals you see are some number of microvolts at a reasonable range. I think Joe wanted to break in with a question or a comment on this particular subject. Whiskey 2, Baker, Mike, Papa, K2LIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Take a quick question on your quality of your transmission.
Okay, I'm hearing a little bit of static, and I'm pretty sure that's what's coming through the repeater, and I'm guessing it's because of rain in the area. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
No, Dick. Bernie just called me. Are you listening to yourself on the input? He hears a hum, and it's considerable.
Interesting. John, are you hearing a lot of hum coming out of the repeater? Over to you, John.
No, it's not coming out of the repeater. It's only on the input. He said the repeater's cleaning it up. I tried to listen to you on the input, but you're a little down in the noise. I can't tell.
Okay. If you give a listen to me right now, is there an extra hum on my signal? If you listen to it right now, I'll give you a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No, Dick, I just switched to the input, and you came in loud and clear. No hum at all.
No hum in Rockaway either, Dick, on the input.
Glad to hear that, Barry.
WS2N.
WS2N. Paul, we'll get to you in a second. So, yeah, I can tell that Eric is in a noisy area. He may be hearing things that are not real. Because I'm listening to my own signal, I hear a little bit of static in the background because I think there's some precipitation noise going on right at the repeater where I think it's raining.
No, that was K2YO, Bernie.
Okay, yeah, Bernie, you want to say something? Go right ahead. Yeah, that last transmission was super noisy, so I didn't hear that. Let me go over to Joe now. Joe wanted to make a comment. W2, Baker, Mike, Papa, K2RAW. You got it, Joe.
Thank you for picking me up. Just a quick question. You had mentioned multimeters, and my original multimeter finally died. Do you have any recommendation on a good, moderately priced multimeter? Back to you.
That's a tough one. Many of the $100 class and sometimes $50 class, sometimes $150 class, of modern-day digital voltmeters, and some of them also have a way of giving you an analog scale simultaneous with the digital scale. Some of them are awfully good. Hewlett Packard makes a good one, but it's pricey. I can't think of some of the brand names. John, you own an awful lot of test equipment. If somebody asked you for a good brand name of a modern-day digital voltmeter, what brand would you recommend, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet?
Yeah, Dick, I would just go on eBay. They have ones roughly around $50, $60. They're excellent. I have about three of them. And it's the type of thing that if you do blow it up, you can throw it away. You don't want to do that with an HP. But they're so prolific on eBay, you can go crazy. And they're very reasonable prices. China seems to be the master. And they work, and they're pretty accurate.
Yeah, Joe, from what I'm sensing, from what my experience is, the experience of the guys that I work with, and what John is saying right now, it's hard to go wrong when you buy a modern-day digital voltmeter from a reliable source. And I think most of the stuff you're going to find on eBay and Yahoo, wait a minute, I can't think of the name of the other major seller of equipment. The web web addresses. Why can't I think of the name of these guys? Anyhow, most of them are pretty good. I prefer the kind of meter that says that in the AC scale it measures true RMS. But that's me. You're going to pay some extra. You're going to pay a good 50% more for a true RMS meter. Because the ones that don't say true RMS, for a pure sine wave of AC signal you're measuring, they tell the truth. When it's a non-sine wave, they don't tell the truth, whereas the true RMS meters do tell the truth on non-sinusoidal waveforms.
Got a model number for you, Dick.
Go right ahead with a model number. And name one of the good mail order houses where you can buy things like this from, other than eBay. Over to you, John.
This one I actually got from eBay. It was cheaper than any of the ones in the catalog. Made by Triplett, and it's a 9045. True RMS and capacitance, has everything you need. Very nice little meter. Very light. I think it takes a 9-volt battery and runs well.
Roughly how many dollars on that one, John?
I think it was around $76, something like that, $78.
So you can tell, Joe, it's hard to go wrong. Most of the modern-day available digital voltmeters are so good. This is the one place in the world where I might not buy a used one, unless it was super cheap, like $10. Because if you buy a reasonable brand digital voltmeter and don't keep throwing it down a flight of stairs, you're likely to use it for the next 10 years of your life and just replace the 9-volt battery once every year and a half, in which case owning a brand new one is very, very justified. When it comes to brand new ham radio equipment, the good stuff these days is $2,000. They're buying brand new. I'm not in favor of it. I'm a big used fan. But on the digital voltmeter, go buy a brand new one. And why can I not think of the brand name of the one that's on the bench at the salt mine? A very nice one, but it's going to cost you a little bit more money.
Is it a Fluke?
That's the brand name I'm looking for. Yeah, Fluke makes a very nice one, but it's a bit more pricey. I don't think you can buy the kind of Fluke I'd like for less than $150. What do you think, John?
No, you're absolutely right, Dick. Probably closer to $200. And, yeah. And, you know, when something like that goes out, now, what I've done, I have an HP lab voltmeter, a four-wire, two-wire lab phone. And this unit was $3,000, and I've compared this little Triplett to that, and it's right on the money, so you can't go wrong.
Now, in my opinion, Joe, if you're buying a meter, and it's the very first one, and you're going to be knocking around with it, buying one of these $50 or $75 ones is very justified. Consider buying someday a second one, which has built-in scales that will measure frequency and measure capacitance. Some of them will measure capacitance, some of them will measure inductance, and some of them will measure frequency. They only go to maybe only a megacycle or two on frequency, and the capacitance, maybe it starts at 100 picofarad and goes to 10 microfarad, and the inductance, it's also a small range, but there are times when those things are very handy. And some of them even have a clamp-on ammeter function. So these handheld digital voltmeters these days, boy, you're getting an awful lot for your money. My very favorite one, somebody did something really bad to it. They put it in the 20 ampere full-scale current reading range and put it across the 110-volt line. My goodness, did he create smoke and flames inside when he did that. And I've gone through the process because I like that meter so much, of buying the individual chips and whatever and repairing it. And when I look at the big picture, what I was doing was just an experiment and frustration. I was doing it out of simple pride. I like fixing things, and I wasted an awful lot of time. I probably put $400 of my man hours into fixing that meter, which I could have easily bought brand new, another one just like it, for $70, if you know what I mean. So meters are a bit different when it comes to used versus new and repair, compared to other kinds of ham radio equipment. Back to you, Joe, in case you need some fill on all of this. W2, Baker, Mike, Papa.
Additional comment for Joe.
Go ahead, John.
From the handheld.
Copy, Dick. This also measures capacitance, temperature, it has the diode function. It's got everything you could want, and it measures frequency duration.
N2EO.
Yeah, hearing Rich N2EO. Go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Yeah, Dick, a good website, they got a lot of test equipment, Marlon P. Jones Associates, MDJA.com. They got some really good stuff on there.
Okay, mpja.com. Got some good test equipment. But that along with eBay and trying to think of another one of the famous websites that sells equipment. It's hard to go wrong, as you can tell, Joe. This is one of the cases where you don't necessarily have to buy a particular brand name. Most likely the measurements you and I make, if we had, let me pick a number, 5 or 8% accuracy, 5 or 8% error capability. In other words, if you wanted to measure 1 volt and it measured 1.05 volts, that's really not going to be a serious situation for most of the things that we do. And so super accuracy is not required. Super ruggedness, unless you're going to be throwing it down a flight of stairs, is not required. But do consider some of these other functions on the second one that you buy. And if you're really interested in electronics as much as I think you are, Joe, I think you're going to end up owning 2 or 3 of these things throughout your career. They're really, you get a lot for your money on these things these days. W2, Baker Mike Papa, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Another comment, Jake, in 2 a.m.
Stand by, Rich. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you all very, very much for your help. I was just on, as you were speaking, I went to eBay and then I went to Amazon, and it's actually cheaper. The Triplight 1945 is cheaper in Amazon. So I think I'll start there, and I'll report back so you know how I made out. Thank you all very, very much. W2BMP.
Very fine, Joe. And would you believe Amazon is the one that I couldn't think of? Mine goes blank sometimes.
So the happy customer.
Yeah, we can send him a bill, John. N2E, I'll go right here with you for the comments, Rich.
I take that website, MPJA, Marlon P. Jones. They have a lot of good stuff. They import from China. And I bought my LCR meter from them. That's where Hal K60PC turned me on to that talking volt meter, which they no longer make. But they have some interesting stuff in the $20 to $30 price range. And like John did, I compared it against a 4.5-digit, what do I have? It's a B&K, this little $30 meter, and it was right on the money also. MPJA.com, a lot of interesting stuff other than just test equipment at that website.
So, Joe, when you get a chance to buy one of those meters and after you've been using it for a week, please come back and let us know what you think of it. And I think you almost can't go wrong. You're getting a lot for your money these days. And there's various ways that you could do metrology-like measurements in your laboratory. In other words, if you're a little bit suspicious that it's reading high or low in voltage, one of the many things you can do is go to the tune-up clinic that's run by Andy, W-A-T-C-D-L, at each one of the major Limark functions. He brings down a lot of instrumentation. You give him warning ahead of time, he'll bring down one of his high-class meters and check the voltage accuracy of your particular meter, if that's what you want to do. And there's lots of other ways you can do it. There's ways you can establish a standard. But some of these meters that will measure temperature, capacitance, inductance, frequency, clamp-on ammeter functions, AC and DC current, oh boy, you can have a grand old time with these meters. There are kinds of handheld digital voltmeter-like things for a few more bucks, and these get a little bit more pricey, where now there's a liquid crystal display that acts like an oscilloscope. I've seen quite a few of those. Believe it or not, I don't like them because they tend to have a kind of a sampling oscilloscope function, and there's about 10 different ways you can display a waveform on that screen, on that oscilloscope-like screen. That is not the truth. And so you got to be very careful with those. A real oscilloscope, to me, is a lot more valuable than some of these handheld things, unless you're really pressed for time and position and whatever. I've used handheld network analyzers, handheld spectrum analyzers, and you do take a compromise. Rodin Schwartz makes a very good handheld spectrum analyzer. That's the good news. The bad news is it's pricey. You're not likely to buy one of those right up front, if you know what I mean. So, the oscilloscope functions, I'm not as happy with.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But maybe that's just me. Let me drop. Maybe that's just me when it comes to the oscilloscope-like functions. I'm not so happy with the handheld, compact, flat-screen oscilloscope function, and they're getting better all the time. There's even a time domain reflectometer type thing, and there's an antenna analyzer like thing. Some of those antenna analyzers, MFJ makes a fairly nice